Welcome to everyone who's on the call. My name is Stuart McGurney. I work for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and I'm speaking to you from Trenton, New Jersey today. Welcome to everyone who's joining today's internet session on TRIAD, which is sponsored by EPA and the TRIAD Community of Practice, also known as the TRIAD Co-op. And this is part of TRIAD Month, and this is the second of seven sessions of training that are being offered during this TRIAD month. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which comprises the front page of today's seminar, and there you'll find short abstracts of the two presentations we're going to have today, one by Robert Hale and one by Tom Pelea. And on there you'll find the speakers' email addresses, and you will have the ability to email questions to them directly even after the date of this seminar if you have any follow-up information you wish to obtain. For those of you who are joining on the phone lines, again, just to repeat something that Gene mentioned a few moments ago, that please put your phones on mute. Don't put us on hold, because that will introduce some background music in many cases, and everyone will get to share that in addition to the presentation, so we don't want to have that happen. So please put your phone on mute. If you are dialing in from a cellular phone or a phone without a mute capability, you can hit *6 to place your phone on mute, and then hit *6 again to unmute your phone at any point. The two presentations we have today will be given in about 35 minutes or so. We've also allocated question and answer sessions at the end of both presentations, and then there'll be some time at the very end for additional questions and answers if you have any. And there's several ways you can generate questions. Either you can dial in or type in your questions to the Clune website. They'll appear automatically on my screen, and then what I'll do is raise some of them with the speakers after their presentations, again at the end. Or there'll also be an opportunity, if there are questions that you have that occur at the spur of the moment, you can also offer those as well at the appropriate times. We ask that you wait until the appropriate QA session until you address those. If you're experiencing any technical difficulties, there are staff on the line, Gene and others, who will be able to address that to you. And the presenters will be also announcing the slide numbers, so as you go through the presentation, you can keep track of where they are. So, the only other things to mention here before we get started is that these seminars are both recorded and archived on Clune. So after about a couple weeks, maybe 1 to 2 weeks, you'll be able to download it in several forms from the Clune website. So if you want to hear this again, or you have colleagues who were unfortunately unable to be present today, you will be able to do so at your convenience. So today's session is titled TRIAD Communications and Systematic Planning. Again, it's sponsored by the U.S. EPA Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. And if I can ask Gene at this point, well, let's see. It doesn't look like Robert Howe is available right now. So we're going to ask Tom if you're available.
I'm here, Stu.
Okay, great. So we're going to ask everyone to, if they could, move to slide 33. That's the beginning of Tom's presentation, and we'll go through to the end of the slides and come back and cover Robert's slides when he joins the call. So without further ado, I want to introduce Tom Pelea, and he will speak to you right now. Tom?
Yes, good morning and good day, everybody. My name is Tom Pelea. I am an environmental engineer with CH2M Hill, speaking to you from Denver today. This is a presentation that I gave originally at the UMass Triad Conference last June in 08, and that's since evolved just a little bit to keep current with state of practice. I've been involved in several Triad projects, and being an engineer, have noticed a a role for decision tools. So lots of information is being collected and trying to integrate all that information into the decision-making process, specifically technology selections, remediation strategies, et cetera, has been a bit of a challenge. So my presentation today is focused on decision tools for integration of Triad with site management. And I am on slide 33, moving on to slide 34. The objectives of the presentation are, first of all, to define the need to integrate the copious amounts of data into the site management routine. Second is to describe how to apply these tools and utilize them in an efficient and functional way to make site management decisions. Third of all, show that these tools can be used to sustain the long-term viability of Triad approaches. Most of you have probably heard that, you know, Triad is being exploited for multiple different reasons. It's not really just for characterization anymore. And thus, my statement at the bottom of the slide here, Triad is a philosophy, is because I really think that the tenets of Triad, systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement techniques really can be applied for the full breadth of the site management routine, everywhere from characterization all the way to site closeout. So I left that up there to try to get your attention anyway and try to make a pitch for Triad as part of our work every day. On slide number 35 is a statement of the problem. And if you've been involved in Triad projects, you know that they collect a ton of data. And without good data management techniques, inevitably some of that data can get lost. Or even wasted if there's evaluation tools that can't be used in a real-time manner to keep up with the relatively rapid pace of a Triad project. Obviously, if this data gets lost or wasted, then, you know, potentially uninformed or not completely informed decisions can be made. And in fact, that sort of defeats the purpose of the Triad project because from the get-go, you're really only collecting the data that you need. So most of that data is useful for and important to decision-making. And so, therefore, the problem statement or the challenge we're faced with is integrating that data into a format that can essentially facilitate efficient decision-making. On to slide 36, continuation of the problem statement. Practical and accessible tools are needed to, again, facilitate that data evaluation and make informed decisions. Anyone can collect a ton of information, but the real challenge is really to optimize the data use and collect, you know, the minimum amount of data to serve as many remedial decisions as possible. Slide 37 is attempted at trying to illustrate how Triad can be integrated into the prominence or some of the primaries components of site management. Obviously, during the site assessments and remedial investigation stage, that's the traditional Triad incorporation or integration. What I'm proposing here is that it also can be functional during a feasibility study stage where you have a leg of that flowchart going off to the left to execute Triad, evaluate conceptual site model, and assess site direction and execute decision analysis needed to really progress to the next stage of remediation. And so that similar, feedback loop is really integrated here where we are considering the conceptual site model at pretty much every stage of our project and using Triad to the extent practical to get us to the place that's necessary to reduce uncertainty and really close those data gaps and make a move forward. Obviously, at the end of it, you hope you can get site closure. That's the holy grail there at the bottom. But in some cases, you are left with a contingency. And thus, the football player, the punter there, where you have a contingency option that if everything's not going according to plan, you do have a plan B sort of thing. On to slide 38. What we've got here is my proposal in that we have the traditional Triad scope up front in this flowchart or up top in the flowchart. You've got the three tenets, you've got the systematic planning, you've got the dynamic work strategies and the real-time measurements that are all going into some sort of data management or database. You're compiling data, you're creating visualizations. There's lots of good techniques out there. What I'm proposing then is that the output of these data analyses methods go into a couple of different tools. First of all is a tool where you're evaluating SCM, in this case, site conceptual model certainty, and at the same time evaluating the direction of your site. So I mentioned I'm an engineer. I'm handed characterization data all the time. You know, what I'm proposing here is that the technology selections and site direction, as I'm calling it a little more generically here, be considered during the data collection stage, such that you're analyzing your uncertainty and you're evaluating your direction at the same time to try to get a good focused data set that's optimum for your data analysis. And that's really the box that falls underneath these two. Your decision analysis, which will be the third tool that I talk about today, is really that tool which integrates all the different alternatives, assesses or evaluates criteria, and then rationalizes a decision. On slide number 39, so in a little more depth here, what I'm talking about is these triad decision analysis tools for practical, real-time data management and decision-making. The first is the conceptual site model. I think I messed the acronym up there. It really should be CSM, checklist and certainty screening tool. The second is the real-time model, I'm calling it. It's more just a glorified spreadsheet for assessing remediation direction. And the third is use of a multi-criteria decision analysis to integrate that data and, again, systematically rationalize the decision to try to get the project moving forward. As I mentioned earlier, these three tools are applicable to a broad range of site management decisions. They can be useful for something as simple as deciding when to stop your triad project. Has your uncertainty been reduced enough to the point where the project team is satisfied and can now move forward with, you know, perhaps evaluating alternatives for remediation? It can also be used to decide whether a partial mass removal strategy should be taken at a particular project. A DNAPL site, for example, where maybe your conceptual site model and all the data that you're collecting is telling you you've got a tall order ahead of you. If you have low permeability media with non-aqueous phase bound within it, for example, there are some red flags there that can tell you that, you know, the chances of achieving an MCL in a reasonable time frame may be a little lower, and maybe perhaps the team should be considering a partial mass removal as our initial step. It can also be used to define a soil excavation volume during one of these projects that actually executes triad and the remedial action all in one shot, for example. It can be used to identify a site exit strategy, remedial direction. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. And it can also be used on the back end of a remediation project when you're actually operating a treatment system or even performing LTM, for that matter, long-term monitoring, and trying to assess whether that process can be optimized. These tools are pretty generic like that. On slide number 40, I should mention that just like for any triad project, and especially for some of these tools, which I'll show you some details here about in a minute, they're not particularly complex, but they do require project team commitment. The team has to be committed to achieving consensus. And this is nothing new for triad projects requiring a committed team. They need to be engaged, and it is a critical success factor, because if we cannot get consensus, if we don't have each person involved, we cannot come up with a decision that's essentially endorsed by the team. So in the case of these tools, there actually is some homework to do, and therefore the added level of involvement or commitment is actually, you know, additional. And as we all probably know from just standard projects, don't even have to be a triad project, but consensus building, especially with environmental data, is challenging. So it requires a certain amount of listening and consensus building and, you know, quick steps to identify if additional data is needed or not, for example. Or so that's enough I'll say about the project commitment. Okay, on slide 41, let's assume for now that we have the triad data. So we've gone out, we've done our initial phase of project data collection. Let's say we're at one of these intermediate meeting points during the triad project and we're deciding what to do next. Well, one of the objectives of most of these triad projects is to reduce uncertainty. Well, what exactly does that mean? It's a very, very vague statement and can be applied many different ways. But what we've got here is a couple of tools to help facilitate that decision. Again, looking at the conceptual site model, CSM, and site direction concurrently, I think, helps you determine whether that data, enough. So at the same time you're collecting data, you're also looking at where you're headed to try to optimize that data set. So these are two synergistic tools created very similarly to assist the project team with how much data is enough and what is the general site direction we're going to take with all this data. On slide number 43 is a quick summary of the first tool. It's a CSM, or Conceptual Site Model Checklist Certainty Screening Tool. Both of these tools I'm going to be talking about next are simple spreadsheets developed specifically for projects. So I'm presenting you some Excel graphics. This is not proprietary information and is available for you if you're interested. Obviously, it's modifiable for each project. It's meant to basically facilitate decisions. But it's intended to be just a simple spreadsheet that pulls a lot of data into a single resource for efficient review. And it does. It assesses when enough is enough. So it itemizes each component of the conceptual site model, and it asks specific questions about the user's level of understanding. The nice thing about it is that it explicitly brings out uncertainties. So as you work together as a project team, and this is the homework, each person essentially fills this tool out, you can see when you bring all these tools or when you bring all these spreadsheets together before your meeting, you can see where opinions are similar and where they're dissimilar. So it does. It opens your eyes to what's known and what's unknown from the various different people's backgrounds. Typical projects involve regulators, site owners, consultants, third parties, et cetera, we're each coming from different backgrounds, geology, engineering, whatnot, and I'll see data a little bit differently. But what is nice is you pull all of those opinions together, you add some constructive discussion, it lays it all out on the table, and you can be left with, after you reach some consensus, what is your level of certainty on the site? Have you reduced it to answer that question for the project? On slide number 44 is an overview of the spreadsheet itself, and you're going to have to expand this on your computer screen to really see the detail. I've got a slide coming up that shows it in a little more detail. But as an overview, it's pretty simple. Again, it on the left-hand side, it lists in this particular case the technical factors from T1 all the way down to T8. It frames each conceptual site model component as a question to be answered. And on the right-hand side is a very simple process of weighting, or importance is that third column from the right, where you give it a weight in your particular case that has to be agreed on for site-specific conditions. You basically provide an answer to that question, and it calculates a score for each of the conceptual site model criteria. It adds all the criteria together, and at the very bottom, in the bottom right-hand corner, it calculates a score for you. On the next slide, you can see that in a little more detail, on slide 45 here. The top question, the first one, is the obvious one. Do you understand your source or your release mechanisms at the site? Answers can be framed in the case I have here with drop-down boxes, or they can be assigned, different. you know, qualitative criteria. We chose numeric in this case to try to get ourselves a little more, just try to refine our scores because we were doing this for multiple sites at the same time, and we wanted to see some difference or some variation in the scores to be able to compare them easier. So we chose, you know, a numeric scoring process. That's, you know, nothing, it's obviously something you can adjust. The weight or importance, again, this is real basic math. The score is calculated based on your weight times an answer to give you a score. And the weight is something you have to decide, again, as a project team. Is this a pertinent criteria? For example, I think on the list is one factor related to surface water or groundwater interface. If you have no surface water impacts or potential impacts, you give that a weight of zero. That essentially nullifies the criteria and takes it out of your score equation. So again, just to try to give you an idea of some of the tools that are being used out there. On slide number 46, I think where this becomes particularly useful is when you're looking at a portfolio of sites. And on slide 46 is these same technical factors with, you know, sites A through H, each having been scored. So that we, for this a military base in this case, can see which sites need work or have low certainty, and which sites are actually, you know, doing pretty well. I think that's where the value of this comes because it is quite a subjective process, and necessarily so. But if you have the same project team and they're all working on multiple sites similarly, in this case it was a site management portfolio at a military base. The real value comes in when you essentially compare the scores relative to one another. It's going to be very difficult with different project teams to compare, you know, a site in California to a site in Florida and have that really mean anything. But if you do have the scoring done systematically, it could be a very, very useful tool to help you optimize your portfolio. Well, that's slide 46. You can use some simple color codings here. In this case, we used a red and orange to sort of make those jump out at you, which CSM factors are needing the work and which ones are not. So that's the CSM certainty tool on slide 47. Again, that's, you know, the first step is really intended to try to make sure that you're collecting the right data so that your scores improve over time. And hopefully that's what happens. But now that you understand that, how do you know? How do we sort of integrate this with the site management routine? So this is where it jumps out really from triad into more into a site management. Is with this data, what are you going to do with it? Well, that's this next model that we pulled together, which really assesses remediation direction. It tackles the question of, you know, now that we know this data, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but not too much. I pretty much need to be looking at the endpoint throughout the whole entire project. Where should we be headed with this? So site direction is useful to optimize that data collection effort. As I mentioned earlier, you know, if you find Dean apple in a fine-grained soil matrix, that's going to mean something different for the project than if you just have dissolved phase and low concentration, you know, large plume, for example. So the results of this tool are really used to reassess and reprioritize your data triad data objectives into focused collection on data to define an exit strategy or to come as close as possible to that. That is something that we've been trying to do is to, you know, create another useful end product of a triad project. If you're able to assess remediation direction, essentially draft the site exit strategy when you're done with the project. What is particularly, and the reason, one of the reasons why this tool got evolved in the first place is because, you know, we were on a particular triad project and the budget was limited. We started finding all sorts of things that we didn't expect and certainly didn't budget for. And we really had to reprioritize our data collection efforts. So again, this sort of helped us. You know, we started thinking maybe a partial mass reduction approach is a little more prudent out here. And we, you know, obviously took a much coarser look at some of the source geometry, for example, in that case. On slide number 49 is an overview of this next spreadsheet. It looks very, very similar to the previous CSM, but the questions are different. Same setup, technical factors and management factors in this case, to assess site direction or remedial direction in this case. You're asking some questions about understanding of regulatory requirements, in terms of stakeholders willing to accept risk, things like that. So these are the type of the management questions that we were raising. And again, these were all questions determined by the project team themselves to try to come up with, an answer to the question, is enough enough? On slide number 40 or 50, I guess it is a close-up of the questions that were involved with this particular spreadsheet. The technical factor two, is there a potential or real risk to human or ecological exposure from contaminants at the site? Again, the importance value is there. The certainty, in this case, we didn't have drop-down boxes. We allowed essentially, whole number or integer number data entry there. But same calculation, certainty times the importance gives you a score. There's sub-questions here, just like the last one, to try to help people or try to guide people through the question if it's a little ambiguous. Some of these do tend to tackle very large subjects, but the way the intent was is that your certainty is highest for the example where you have multiple lines of evidence and data collected that all converge, let's say, on the same answer. So, even though I have 100% certainty here that the technical factor 2 is understood, it's actually very rare to be 100% certain. So it's just, again, it is a very subjective process, but when you bring all the team members and all the scores together and you start discussing similarities and differences, and that's where the end point really becomes particularly useful. In this case, on slide 51, this is the scoring process. So there's a subtotal for the technical factors. There's a subtotal for the management factors. You add those two together to get your total. Case, we had a score interpretation table where, depending on the score we got, it's going to tell us what direction might make sense at this particular site. Our site scored a 16.25, amazingly enough, and we determined, the project team determined, that this site is extraordinarily well suited for aggressive source remediation. So in this case, we had a source that was well defined. Understood, the source was complete, we had no infrastructure in the way, it was relatively shallow, and we didn't have a lot of low permeability zones to deal with. I mean, that's just for an example of where a score might be high. Scores might be low at sites where you've got facilities in the way, you're not able to investigate enough to define the source zones. You have uncertainties of rebound back diffusion. And you've got a relatively, multiple source scenario where you may not have actually identified them all. That's a scenario where you would get a low score. And perhaps, down towards the bottom end of the score interpretation table at the bottom of the slide here, maybe less aggressive, containment type approaches might make sense until you can better define. If you were to try to go for source reduction, you obviously need a little better delineation in those source zones. So that's that. Slide number 52 takes us to the next step. So we basically optimize the data collection, and we have a general understanding of where we're headed. What's the next step? Obviously, it's decision time, right? Those two tools are pretty subjective and, meant to try to gain consensus. And the beautiful thing is it gets people thinking about the big picture as well as the details. And essentially when it comes down to exit strategy development and things like that, the process is actually simplified a little bit, having gone through, this incredibly explicit process of identifying what's known and unknown. So the third tool here is really a multi-criteria decision analysis technique. It's a software package. I'll be presenting in the Criterium Decision Plus, but there's multiples out there, and you can even build your own. We can basically rationalize a decision using a systematic approach. So the word systematic is all about triad. This is particularly nice because it does, these multi-criteria decision analysis tools have the ability to pull together a lot of different information and actually, again, explicitly address uncertainties. So we can resolve these complex problems with multiple variables and competing objectives. And the synergies with Triad include real time. This is a tool that can be done, via a web interface or in a face-to-face meeting, however you may have it set up. And done relatively quickly. You know, in a matter of an hour or 2 hours, you could basically have gone through the alternatives, the criteria, having done a little bit of homework, of course, and come up with various different options and looking at what the different, possible outcomes are. As I mentioned, it can be used for qualitative and quantitative criteria. It does quantify uncertainty, but most importantly, it builds consensus among multiple stakeholders for some of these key decisions. Slide number 54 is an example input. Again, this is the Criterium Decision Plus tool. There's multiples out there, where on the right-hand side of this, it's basically a spider web diagram, but it shows you from right to left your alternatives. In this case, we were getting into selection of a biological remedy or a chemical oxidation remedy. You can see those two alternatives are there on the right-hand side, ACB and MNA is the top alternative. That's the aerobic co-metabolic bio. Or the ISCO is in situ chemical oxidation and Monter natural attenuation option. Moving to the left, we've got the sub-criteria, the primary criteria and the sub-criteria. So you can see that, cost there at the bottom. You got capital and present worth. You got process control flexibility. You got remediation time frame. Yada, 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 land use impacts, risk to indoor air. All these criteria were deemed important in terms of making this decision. So basically the project team goes through each of these and quantifies a score for each of these. Obviously the cost is relatively easy. Those are just numbers. Some of them, like the operations, land use impacts, construction impacts, these are relatively qualitative. So we're looking at things like, impacts to the neighbor's operations and things like that. At the end of the day, what we're hoping to do is achieve that goal on the left-hand side, which is the goal of selecting the remedy. Don't have enough time. Could probably spend the whole entire seminar session just on this decision analysis process, but what is particularly useful is some of the graphical output that comes. What you can see here is a couple of different bar charts. At the top is the two bar chart showing.
Hello.
Okay, hello. Just please put your phone on mute. Thank you.
If you don't have a mute button, simply hit *6 to mute the line.
Thank you. On slide 55 in the upper left-hand corner, we have the results of the decision analysis.
Yeah.
So the blue bars are essentially telling you the total value or the score for each of the alternatives. The ACB and MNA option at a 0.609 score.
Tom, I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt you. This is Jean Valent. Whoever's speaking on their telephone, we can hear you, sir. I'm sure you're on.
You can bring it around. And you just,
if you haven't done so already, I just please ask that you mute your telephone line. Hit *6 to mute your line because we can hear your phone conversation right now. If I don't hear him mute his line in about 10 seconds, I'll globally mute everyone. And if I do have to do that because I don't know how long his conversation is going to go on for, I apologize for that inconvenience, which does sound like I'm going to have to take these steps. So I'm going to hit a key. I'm going to globally mute the telephone lines. You'll hear an announcement. I need the instructors, once they hear the announcement that the line has been globally muted,
please,
to hit *6 to unmute your line to continue talking. So again, Stu, Tom, and Robert, I'll need you to hit *6 after you hear that message, and you'll be able to continue talking.
Thanks,
I apologize. Let me just mute these lines right now.
The leader has muted your line.
So.
Okay. Can everybody hear me now?
Tom, we can hear you. You're absolutely fine. Again, it's *6 to unmute your line. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Nice work, Gene. Okay, I am on slide 55 with the presentation of the example decision analysis results. And as I mentioned, in the upper left-hand corner are the total scores. Again, these are values that are determined from your software. The numbers are only important from a relative perspective when you're trying to compare different alternatives. And you can see in this case that the ACB alternative, scoring at a 0.609, is doing better, scored better than the chemical oxidation at a 0.52. What's particularly useful is the gray error bars associated with those. So for each of those criteria that we assigned value, we had uncertainty associated with each of them. And so that you can see even still in the most uncertain aerobic co-metabolic bio scores, it still is better, so that the left-hand side of that gray error bar on the ACB option is still greater than the best scoring on the chemical oxidation. So again, real nice tool to be able to use to understand the values of your data collection and where it goes in terms of a decision, and then also understanding the uncertainty of that decision. In the bottom right-hand corner is basically understanding the contributions to each score. So you can see on the far right-hand corner, we've got red as the implementability, you've got green as the treatment effectiveness, you've got blue as your treatment time frames, yellow's cost, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see, really, the reason why that ACB alternative is scoring better is largely because of the implementability criteria. In this case, we had health and safety concerns on the chemical oxidation, where we're using food grade on the aerobic co-metabolic bio option. So you can see right then and there, real quickly, how your decision is being made to help, again, get yourselves to that constructive endpoint. So there you have it, slide 56, data is collected, it's consistent with the direction, and now that you've benchmarked your certainty, your conceptual site model certainty, your decision analysis tool can be used to affirm your path forward. So to wrap things up here, and I think I'm on pretty good time here, the three tenets of Triad are easily assimilated into the full breadth of site management routine. You know, groups are coming up with ways to work with adaptive site management, just like the U.S. Navy. We're understanding much better now that we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the subsurface, and we're coming up with different ways to adapt to that. These tools can be helpful to that as well as Triad. A critical success factor for Triad is really efficient integration of the data into the decision-making process. So again, as I mentioned, Triad projects are typically pretty fast-paced. You need these tools set up and relatively a good facilitator to make sure folks are in alignment and talking. And the bottom line really is, with these tools, you're able to make better informed decisions. And that's really what advances sites to closure. So I conclude with the Triad as a philosophy statement again. I do think it's a very, very useful process, not just in remediation, but life. But anyway, that's all I have. On slide number 58 is my point of contact information. If you're interested in any of the spreadsheets, I'll be more than happy to share them. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them now. Thank you.
This is Stu. Thank you, Tom, for a very...
The leader has unmuted your line.
Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Hi, this is Stu. Thanks to Tom for a very informative and entertaining presentation. I'd like to open the floor for the audience to ask Tom some questions about his presentation. There were no online questions submitted during his talk, so if anyone has any specific questions for Tom, now's the time to ask them.
And I didn't plant anybody in the audience either.
Well, actually, this is Stu, and I actually have one. Tom, is the software that you have developed here, or the application you developed here that you discussed, is that commercially available to people? Is that if a Triad practitioner wanted to use it, how would they go about applying it?
Yeah, the the last tool, the multi-criteria decision analysis, is a commercially available software package. I think I even put their website address on the slide that you can grab that one. The other two are just simple spreadsheets. And, I have those tools. Shoot me an email and I'll send them to you. They're not going to fit your project as I send them to you. You're going to have to modify those. But it's pretty much shareware, I guess we could call it. And it's open for anybody to use as needed. I can personally say that I continue to use these tools today and for multiple different reasons. I do get involved in a fair amount of optimization work, and they become particularly useful for optimizing sites. It all comes down to conceptual site model certainty. And if you don't understand the site, you've got data gaps that are going to impact some of your decisions. And it becomes particularly valuable for almost any discussion you have about site remediation to really benchmark yourself before proceeding. So, my point of contact information is there. They're also actually posted on the U.S. Navy website for access as well.
This is Robert Howe. I had a question as well, and I think you partially answered it, but when do you think in what circumstances do you believe it would be the most advantageous to use this type of tool?
These really evolved out of need. I can say that if you're developing the tools from scratch, it needs to be a relatively sizable project. Probably not going to be particularly useful for your standard underground storage tank site. We did apply this on a DNAPL site as well as some of the larger petroleum sites. I think there is an economy of scale. However, once you do get some hands-on with the tools, I am actually finding myself using them even for sites as simple as a landfill land use control site. Because there are important management-related factors to land use controls and administrative things that are really good to get out on the table. So the economy scales, I think, becomes less important as you start to use the tools and become a little more comfortable with them as you go on.
Hi, this is Rose Forbes calling in from MMR, Massachusetts Military Reservation. I work for the AFC, and I also have some CH2M Hill folks here with me. But my question is, with the emphasis on sustainable remediation these days, are you looking at incorporating, the environmental impact into this process?
Absolutely. And, again, that is a client-specific thing at this point, although we have, essentially started to bring sustainability into all of our decisions these days. So I would say absolutely, and you would normally see on slide 54 your spider diagram of criteria. You can easily add a sustainability criteria into that. Absolutely.
Yeah, that slide is actually what made me want to ask the question.
Right.
All right.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Other questions for Tom?
I'm getting a lot of emails coming through asking for spreadsheets.
Okay.
Yeah, Tom, actually, this is Jean. Is it something that you'd like to have posted on the additional resources page?
I can easily do that if you send me a link. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. All you'll need to do is email it to me. I'll shoot you an email, and then that way anyone who replays the seminar will be able to also download those seminars as part of the collection of additional resources.
Perfect.
Oh, great. We'll get those up for everybody. And just a reminder, if you're online, there's that little orange question mark icon that you can use to submit those questions at any time. If you have a pop-up blocker on, that may be stopping the question form from opening up, so you'll want to disable your pop-up blocker if you're using one.
Okay, any other questions for Tom? Well, let's thank Tom for, again, a very good presentation, and we'll move now to Robert Howe, who will be presenting his talk, which is titled, which the presentation overview is on the website, And Robert's been an active member of the Triad community for many, many years, and always gives a very enlightening talk. And I'll turn the podium over to Robert. Just one additional reminder: at the end of the seminar, at the end of the final Q&A session, there is a seminar feedback form that is accessible by clicking on the tab in the lower right-hand portion of the Kluin website screen. And we ask all the participants in this training today to please fill out that form and send it in. Do it, you know, quickly after the presentation is over so things are fresh in your mind. The EPA and Triad community really find that particular information compilation very, very useful. So, without any further ado, Robert, you ready?
And just a reminder, we had to start things out of order, so
right,
everyone can move to slide number one.
We're going to go right to slide number one, and Robert, you're on.
Okay, thank you very much, Stu and Gene, and we apologize for kind of getting these things backwards. There were mixed signals for us, but I really enjoyed Tom's talk, and this talk was actually developed for the UMass conference by Logan Hackett, who is a member of my staff, a geochemist who is on vacation this week. And it's a compilation of information that we have compiled over the years working for EPA on various sites. It's sort of a process presentation. You know, we have, as a group, collectively working for EPA on numerous sites across the country, tried to develop kind of a process flow for the development of conceptual site models from a triad perspective, basically a holistic type of conceptual site model, and tools that can be used to develop more or less a consensus among stakeholders, and to do that in as efficient and a way as is possible. So, you know, we struggled with this concept, conceptual site models, the whole term, what's involved with a conceptual site model. Is it a pathway receptor network diagram, like the risk assessors call it? Is it a more of an engineering design that engineers use to place a remedy or optimize a remedy? And I think the answer is, for us, it's all those things. Slide two kind of gives a very broad-based overview of our vision of what is the Triad CSM. It basically is written descriptions of geology, hydrogeology, previous histories. It's something that you start out as early as you can on a project. Maybe it's just prior to design, or maybe it's just prior to even doing a PASI, or maybe it's much later in the process when you find out you need to optimize a remedy. It doesn't really matter sort of where you are in the process, but it's something that you want to get together as soon as you can, and because it's going to help you all along the way to improve your cleanup efficiency. It's going to be something that you'll use to evaluate technologies and select monitoring and measurement strategies. So it's something that really is a focal point for everybody to take, you know, complex information from very complex sites or even less complex sites and try to boil them down to their essence that can then be communicated easily among stakeholders, and then, decisions and a path forward can be developed quickly. easily. On slide three, we put together some just generic boxes here of the types of things that you might want to have as part of this triad holistic conceptual site model. Previous investigations, obviously, and description of past use is a very important part, and it's a part that's often overlooked in terms of identifying sources, identifying the deficiencies in the data, and that combined with the geology and the hydrogeology begins to form what we're calling now sort of your preliminary CSM, and usually you include other things you might know or maybe you don't know a lot about them, say the intended use, for example, or what people are envisioning as exit strategies. You kind of throw out your best guess there when you start to develop your preliminary CSM. Potential remedies the same way, pathway receptor networks, and decision criteria all get sort of painted on this preliminary CSM. Usually it's a form where then you take that in, you'll take that form, that raw form that the project team develops, and then you take it out and you start testing it right away in front of the stakeholder group in a systematic planning meeting. And it's out of that systematic planning meeting that you'll start to find out more about what people think the intended reuse should be and or what the exit strategies ought to be. And these things will actually play off of each other and begin to formulate or at least begin to help you understand what's going to be the best path forward, what makes the most sense moving forward. And so the sooner you sort of put all these things into the mix and start to articulate them either in a written form or verbally or in graphical form, all these things will start to play in and get weighed, and there'll be sort of a weight of assigned to a lot of them. And if you want to use Tom's technique, you'll weigh them very specifically, which is a wonderful way of doing this, I think, and something that's not done enough. But these are the general outline. You want to make sure that when you build a conceptual site model, you kind of have these general things in mind. Obviously, there's going to be other things that come in. Maybe there's hydrology, not just geology, or maybe there's mineralogy. Maybe there's other subheadings that go within these generic categories. And so the slide three is not intended to be the catch-all. It's just sort of the general areas, and then you have to customize it based on, the issues at your specific site. Slide four, when you're doing the past use and previous investigations, these are the kinds of things, as I go through the process of developing my CSM work products that I try to think about. What are the contaminants of concern? And that goes back to past use. What was used out there? Having a chemist involved who maybe understands the processes that have been used in the past. What kind of byproducts can come out of those? What past information is available? Where were the release points? Where would they be, from the processes perhaps you had at a site? What's the timing of those releases? Sometimes the timing of the releases can be important in terms of the chemical characteristics of the material. For example, herbicide manufacturing plants prior to the early 80s had very high dioxin levels in it. As you move past 1980, they refined the processes, dioxin levels, are reduced with gasolines and petroleum hydrocarbon products. There's lots of additives like lead gas or other types of tracers that can be very useful for understanding and unraveling sites. So trying to identify the timing for certain types of processes and potential releases is an important part of the previous investigations and past use evaluation in a CSM. Looking at contaminant distributions and uncertainty, of course, I think, is an important part of that. And trying to ID initially what type of pathways could be complete and who the receptors might be are, of course, the traditional risk-based type concept of what a conceptual site model is. And of course, that's very much a part of this more holistic type of approach that we're talking about. Slide number five. So geology and the hydrogeology are typically thought of as part of a conceptual site model. The thing that is important, I think, about these things are in the selection of tools process. What types of tools are you going to be able to use at the site? Are you going to be able to use direct push? Are you going to have to use auger? Or are you going to have to use air rotary? You know, in addition to understanding the risk-based elements of this, geology plays a tremendous role in the selection of tools and methods and helping you understand at what level or what scale you need to collect the data, because the geology and the hydro will control the heterogeneity of the site. If you have blanket sands, even some of those, you can wind up with highly heterogeneous distributions of contaminants because of release mechanism characteristics or chemical characteristics. But certainly your flow conditions, for example, might be more homogeneous, and so your need to do predictive analysis for permeabilities and porosities might be reduced because you have a pretty good confidence that your conductivities are going to be generally high or generally low. So geology and hydrogeology, of course, it's my specialty. It's what I spent a lot of time with, and I firmly believe it's really critical to the conceptual site model. But also the past use and the previous investigations, you start to put those together. You really start formulating kind of this base for your initial CSM, and then, you know, on as you mature this thing, you know, as you go forward. Now, slide six. Slide six is an example of a conceptual site model for a facility that has been studied since the early 90s. It's the former Jackson Ceramic site in Falls Creek, Pennsylvania. This site, you can see by the boundary around the area, kind of shown in a broader pink color, is the wetlands, and then right up above the wetlands to the north and west side of the border that you can see there is the old China manufacturing facility. This was an interesting facility. They basically produced ceramic plates, and then the waste, there was chlorinated solvent waste here. There was also just the leftover rust, as it were, from the China manufacturing process. That material was stored in various areas around the site, including a low-lying area near the site, and then was reused as they needed to into the process, as they needed more feedstock. And so been studied for a long time. A lot of this material had been, because of the connection between the wetlands and these lowlands where this material was being stored, had been transported underneath some railroad tracks and into the 350-acre wetlands, where it was then sort of random or distributed into these beautiful wetlands via surface water transport mechanisms. And so our goal here when we were developing this conceptual site model was to try to just understand how we could go into this fragile environment, do some characterization, try to figure out what was happening there, what risks there are to any recreational users or to the wildlife, in this case the woodcock, in this area, and still try to preserve the wetlands. So the first thing we did was, and this is sort of a typical process that I go through for doing these types of things, is I go to the U.S. Geological Survey and I find out, get a geologic map. And you can see from slide 7, here's the cross-sections and geologic framework or surface map in the area of Jackson Ceramics. And you can see we've got gradually dipping beds, one way into the wetlands, sort of dipping into the wetlands, and then, on the other side, sort of dipping away. It's a fractured sandstone bedrock, fairly well indurated, meaning that direct push was going to meet with limited success once we got to the indurated bedrock. Also meaning that there was a fractured flow system and a pretty decent aquifer just right below the site that was being used regionally as a drinking water source. And of course, we developed maps that showed the drinking water sources in the nearby area, and we also, as part of this evaluation, shown in slide 8, started to look at aerial photos. Aerial photos are not something you think about typically in terms of geology, but in a site like this where temporal variations have occurred over a longer period of time, it's very important to go in and look at these sequential aerial photos and try to figure out, what you can figure out from just a plan view. Or even just from a Google view, a modern Google view is another way to do that. And on this slide 8, you can see that in the upper left-hand corner is the borough or the residential areas. And then you can see some rather bright spots kind of in the upper left-hand corner as well near the residential area. Those are the waste piles of China waste that were present in 1992. You can also see what looks like some of this material sort of leaking underneath these railroad tracks and sort of coming out into a whitish kind of a light plume on the other side of the tracks. And that is actually the lowland area and the drainage pipe where the majority of this material was finding its way into the wetlands and accumulating in a large, what we call the cattail pond. Now, other features that you can get out of here, obviously, and EPA does some really innovative things with epoch analyses, looking at surface water flow, is you can look at the surface water flow directions and you can begin to kind of estimate what they were at this point in time. You can also see an old railroad spur that has since been abandoned, just next to that sort of cloudy white material entering the wetline. This is actually another transport area where surface water flows are going parallel to the railroad tracks and directly to the southwest. This is an important pathway, and a pathway that has changed over time, and if we hadn't examined aerial photos over time, we might have missed or changed our sampling scheme based on that. Now, this also shows another interesting feature, the Sandy Lick Creek, which is the major creek that you can see kind of off to the south and to the east on this photo, is an engineered stream that the Army Corps of Engineers realigned along the edges of this wetland. The original flow into the wetlands came from the north and east and sort of directly into the center of the wetlands. But since, you know, it's been reconstructed, the dynamics in the area have changed. And so this was also an important thing to recognize when that occurred, sort of what entrances there were to Sandy Lick. Sandy Lick has a lot of recreational uses for fishing and so forth. Then looking upstream, we actually found that there was a wood treater up there as well. So this aerial photo was very important, and all the aerial photos that we looked at for trying to start to unravel the surface hydrogeology. And in this case, the hydraulics and surface water flow directions. Now, a second part of the conceptual site model and the previous investigations in this case were there were numerous large investigations conducted at this site prior to us going out there, and we wanted to make maximum use of the existing information. So what I typically try to do is I try to get this information and compile it all into plan views where as much information can be communicated as easily as possible. And slide 9 shows one of these images from one of a series of the investigations sort of compiled together. And what it shows is the XRF results for lead in the wetlands. It also shows the train tracks. It shows the central part of the facility down in the lower left-hand corner. Right up above that, you can see kind of a little circle that shows the disposal area, and it also shows the feeder ditch that led into the wetlands. And so it shows the sampling locations. It also shows the ephemeral ponds and flow patterns and the extent of characterization. So this is a compilation of a number of different things all sort of brought together to portray the past use and the previous investigations and help us to begin to understand the nature and extent and the limitations on our data. In this case, it's pretty extensive. There's lots of information that was collected. And the majority of this information, we also looked at its utility. In other words, what's its quality, relative to being performed under, an established, quality assurance project plan, and also in terms of its reliability, statistically. And this is another important part of what you might be doing in your CSM for evaluating past investigation data. And what we discovered here was that they had done this XRF work. Most of the correlations were in terms of reliability when you looked at it in a linear regression fashion were reliable, provided that they were above a concentration of 1,000 ppm. Below 1,000 ppm, we had scatter that was too great, R squared less than 0.7 as required by the method. A lot more variability in the data for concentrations less than 1,000. And one of the problems here was the initial action levels that were proposed for the wetlands based on the toxicity to the robin, which is a surrogate for the woodcock, was 18 ppm. So we had a big problem just right off the bat. We didn't have data that was good except for if it was above 1,000, and we had action levels that were potentially going to be on the order of 18 from an ecological standpoint. So right away, the preliminary conceptual site model, which is not really preliminary in this case because you had several RIs beforehand, it was more of a mature, what I still call a characterization conceptual site model, was quite mature, and we could analyze enough of the data to know what we really did know with some confidence and what we didn't know, which was the low-level concentration of distributions. And there were some practical things that came out of this as well. The team decided, well, maybe we should do some bio-uptake analysis of the earthworms to determine, you know, is that action level of 18 ppm the only thing we can live with, or really can we live with something higher, like many action levels, you know, for lead are around 400. Could we find some middle ground? And then, once we found that middle ground, could we select a field-based technology, or would we have to use more fixed lab technologies to get the RI complete, to get to where we could move into the FS and into the design? So this information that came out of this exercise was extremely valuable, and there were other things that come into it, like the regression analysis, like the quality assurance and quality of control parameters used on the data, you know, the locations, the, you know, just all those things combined into this holistic CSM, or I call it the characterization CSM for this site. Now, some of the other things we did as part of this was we drew up cross-sections. And not only did we draw up cross-sections, but we did the same thing that we did with our plan view, and that is put in physical features. Some people use cartoons for this. They're fine. I think, you know, trying to keep things within scale the best you can. Cross-sections are great, or even 3D visualizations, like we'll talk about a little bit later, can be great ways to begin to start to understand your data gaps and some of the issues at your site. Now, on this slide 10, you see two lines through the wetlands. One basically that goes essentially from the west to east across the manufacturing area, where they had had unlined ditches where chlorinated solvents were disposed of. And if you look at the purple hatchet marks and you see kind of some wells, one in particular that extends down into the lower horizon shown in the A to A prime cross section, that's the only deep well that was ever established out at this site that went into fractured bedrock. And it was very interesting that we found in this kind of upland area away from the wetlands that the head elevations were different between a shallow screened well and a deep screened well at this location. Well, that meant we had potentially, you know, artesian conditions. And so that's not to be unexpected, I don't think, but it had some impacts on, you know, where we thought contamination might be going, and some of the data actually looked like at one point it was vertically upward gradients, another point it wasn't. And so one of our key data gaps became immediately to verify whether or not we had artesian conditions, because that would control the fate and transport of these chlorinated solvents or any other types of contaminants that we might have, and might indicate that deeper sampling may not be necessary, or, you know, it had a lot of impact in terms of technologies, because if we had to get into fractured bedrock, it costs more, we'd have to use air rotary, various other things. So these cross-sections are really working tools. We also noticed that there were nothing but shallow wells in the wetlands, and nobody had really ever gone down deep enough to get into the fractured bedrock, and so there was a big data gap there. We also knew, you know, down gradient, the B2B prime is more or less, you know, north-south across the wetlands, that we didn't have any coverage there either. We put on a number of trenches that were dug in the area to look at the patent transport of metals along transects as part of a previous investigation. We tried to kind of emulate where the contamination was the highest concentrations, and we just began to build, you know, some kind of, you know, combined representation of the site that could allow us to then identify our data gaps and help as part of the design. And of course, this project is now in the field. Done a lot of that. We would like to go back and sort of update these things. They've done a lot of work out there right now, and we're hopeful that you know, this site will, instead of being studied for another 20 years, will be you know, in the FS and in the reuse phase in the next years or several years. So big site, a big conceptual site model effort. You know, kind of non-traditional because of its surface water elements. But the idea is, you know, when you put these things together, put together comprehensive figures that tell a story. And so, you know, let's look at another one. This is another site in New York City, of all places, in the Bronx, that I've been working on for the last several years, and it's about ready to go into the field. But this is an example of how sometimes you have to think outside the box when you're doing these conceptual site models, and it's driven by site conditions. This area of the Bronx that you can see here in Figure 11 is the Melrose Commons site. The Melrose Commons site is a location for many, many, many historical chlorinated solvent uses, including many you know, garages and dry cleaners, mom-and-pop operations. The city is going in and trying to redevelop this entire area, get rid of the projects, put in you know, single-family homes or condos, healthcare facilities, university or college in the area. And they're just spending, you know, lots of money to get in here, and they want to make sure that the environmental concerns, particularly from vapor intrusion, are addressed. And that, you know, all of these different, I mean, it's a daunting task to try to go back through the records to figure out where all these chlorinated solvent sites might have been, who used them, when they used them. And in fact, to go to do past use in this type of scenario doesn't make much sense in terms of trying to go through the historical records, because you'd be doing it for the next 20 years and you wouldn't be sure that the material was relevant. And so we decided to kind of go at it from a different approach, and that was more of a regional approach. And one of our big issues from a geologic standpoint was, well, we don't have a lot of boring logs in this area. We know bedrock is just below the surface, and it's a marl of some sort that's not very fractured, highly metamorphosed, somewhat impermeable. And then, like much of New York City, the rest of the material is predominantly fill. Mixed bricks and other things, which amazingly enough, a lot of actually came from England at some point after World War II. So a very different geologic environment, if you call it that, and not a lot of coverage over this large area. And so what we did was we said, well, you know, bedrock is going to control the flow of groundwater, and we know we have chlorinated solvent issues out here. What's the best way for us to get a handle on preferential pathways at a site like this, and we started to talk to the stakeholders and talk to everybody else, including the consultant. As it turned out, the best way was to go back to the sewer records, where they installed all these probes down to bedrock across a lot of the site. And so we dug up these bedrock records from the sewers, and we created this bedrock surface map that sort of shows, you know, how down Melrose Avenue, which is to the left, that the north to south trending road there, is kind of in a low, and then you've got some highs to the east of Melrose, and then up on the hill, even farther to the east, you've got some real highs. In fact, you've actually got bedrock outcrops up there in the surface. So the chances on the very right-hand corner of this area to have groundwater impacts, you know, was fairly limited. And but yet you could also distinguish that there were places where you had potential divides. For example, in the northern part of the property, groundwater flowing to the north. But in the lower two-thirds or more of the property, the flow is generally down the trough that goes along Melrose. And, of course, you know, you don't know this, but that's where most of our chlorinated solvent plume issues were identified, although we did go back and decide based on this that we needed to do soil gas across the site, and now we're really moving into the investigative portions of this. We did a lot of different products here, thickness of fill, but this bedrock map was crucial from the sewer information for us to begin to plan the RI, which is going to start in September. So kind of a different idea of how to think outside the box sometimes in different situations and come up with, you know, useful information that then can help you understand flow conditions in this case for chlorinated solvents and groundwater, which are the principal problem.
Robert, this is Stuart. You have about 20 minutes left.
So let's move on and look a little bit more at intended reuse. In our presentation, this figure 12 shows, you know, basically, you know, a ball field, and I always think about it, this is probably a ball field somewhere in the minor leagues, but I also think about the Denver, the Coors field and the Brownfield site that was there and how they used and redeveloped that. And the point of this slide 12 is that basically the reuse will drive in many times the decision criteria and the action levels that are used, as well as, you know, the contamination on a site will drive the reuse. So kind of a push and shove here when you talk about intended use between what you know about the site, the nature of the contamination, and the intended reuse. And there are lots of things to think about here, and in many cases, you find in the highest places where contamination is, sometimes that will dictate the reuse. And in order to come to an economic solution. But it will always, the reuse will always drive the decision criteria, and so, and thus it will drive the technologies that you can use. And it will also help to drive the focus for your sampling strategy. So, reuse is very important, and I think in slide 13 we have an example of kind of another site where we worked through this reuse process, where we had one party that you know, wanted a certain type of reuse, in this case the borough or redevelopment authority. We had another party, in this case Roman Haas, a chlorinated solvent manufacturer who had this facility, and they wanted to slice off a portion of it which had never been contaminated and was outside the facility. They didn't need it anymore. And those are the areas kind of shown in this reuse plan in slide 13 in the purple and even the green. And so this was a vision that the borough had. They wanted to put, you know, mixed-use town center. They wanted to put light industrial, RDA. They wanted some open space, some environmental restoration. We took this into our preliminary conceptual site model, went to some planning meetings, and as it turned out, you know, the owner of the property was not going to release any of this land for residential use. So, or even light industrial offices and so forth, mixed townhouse centers. And, so they just want, they envisioned it as just being a residential reuse because of its proximity to the existing plant. And, so there were lots of conversations about this, and I think it led to us understanding partially how our design could be, would be impacted. For example, in this case, it's under PADEP's Act 2 standards. That control what type of analysis need to be done of dredge materials that they wanted to place onto this site to bring it up to grade. And if we were going to go to a non-fee simple type of an arrangement where they could develop residential, it was going to require a great deal more sampling and analysis, and it just seemed like there was a real disconnect here between the seller and the buyer. That obviously had a big impact on the potential proposed investigation, the cost, and the entire design. And these people just hadn't been talking to each other. So now we're at the point, I think, where people are, you know, on agreement a little bit more. It's going to be a fee simple arrangement. It's going to be something where going to be used for light industrial. You know, some of the open space areas are going to be excluded because they're former landfills. They're not going to even be part of the deal. So when you start to talk about this reuse stuff, I mean, it can totally change your design. And so it's very important to integrate it. And this example of Maple Beach is just such an example. And there are many others. Now, just talking about slide 14, we want to move on there. Obviously, this is an important part of any conceptual site model. It's what a lot of people think of as a conceptual site model, the potential pathway receptor networks. These are important things to do. They become more and more complex as you get into the ecological area or you get into details of the receptors. And, you know, this requires a risk assessor in many, many, many cases to have active involvement, the receptors, the exposure points, all those things. These are an important part of any conceptual site model, and one of the first things we try to do. There are lots of good examples of these that we have, so people can obtain those through triadcentral.org. If you have a site similar, for example, on the coast of a lake or a water body, or if it's inland, has a certain type of contamination, you know, I urge you to go look at some of those examples that we have or contact me and I can point you in that direction. And then you might not have to totally recreate the wheel. But this is like Tom's decision trees. You got to ID those things that are most critical. And then, like he did, I mean, if you want to go that far, you start to weigh them. And that weight then will bring them to the surface and help you design your project. So, enough said with that. Slide 15, we want to talk a little bit about 3D visualizations to present a CSM. This is something that's emerging. Technologies are out there, freeware is out there that does this both on a crude level as well as on a much more sophisticated level. And, you know, these
these 3D visualizations that are available give us a very powerful tool for boiling complex site conditions down to a much more simple type of scenario. And I'm going to go through a few of these. Slide 16 is a site in Phoenix. This site, if you look at slide 16, you can see some red circles in the upper right-hand corner. These are some of the industrial park sources for chlorinated solvents. The problem is here, there's a plume that extends from the right side of the site almost all the way to where you see the little golf course, the holes over there. And then up to the north and west of this location is our municipal supply wells. So obviously a lot of concern about chlorinated solvents, some concern about increase in water demand in the area. They're going to put a bunch of new wells here. It's going to start to drag this chlorinated solvent stuff over towards these supply wells. And the geology is very complex, a series of alluvial fans and colluvial material coming off the nearby mountains to the east, and a lot of finger-pointing going on at this site. It's not my site. I've cleaned my stuff up. No, we don't have an apple here, you know, and bankruptcies and lots of complexities. So in this case, they brought us in to just build a conceptual site model, and I'm going to just talk about the geologic components of this conceptual site model in terms of the impacts on the future work that's being done out there. So if you go to slide 17, this is sort of a, and normally you can do these in movies, and you would start out with slide 16, and then you would rotate it, and you can stop it wherever you want to stop it, and sort of begin to look at slices through the site to understand the geology and the association between the source areas and the downgraded receptor points. And so this is a kind of a, just a brief slide kind of looking from the south at the geology at the site. And what is important to see here is kind of that cluster of red on the surface on the top there. Those are the source areas. And then right below there is a big kind of thick red layer that sort of looks like it's that thins across the face of the figure and then sort of goes off. That is a pretty significant clay layer, pretty impermeable clay layer. But what you see from this is also there's an anastomosing relationship between all these different layers, as you'd expect from these colluvial and alluvial deposits, a pretty complex geology. So if you move to the next slide, 18, this is an interesting slide because this is cutting right through the source areas. You can see the screen levels there. And you can see in one particular well to the farthest right-hand side of this sliced image, is a location that had very high concentrations of chlorinated solvents in it and almost no clay. So that was a key to us that, boy, this is where that stuff's getting down into that yellow, sandy aquifer.
I won't be here tomorrow or Monday.
Move out.
Okay. Thanks,
Uncle. So if you keep going, you know, outside the site, then, and you keep moving down gradient, what you see in slide 19 is that our clay is gone. So whatever protection we had underneath those chlorinated solvent areas and disposal sites, as you move down gradient, that disappears. So that's a very significant finding. And this is a very neat tool when it's done in a movie or it's done live for systematic planning and discussing sampling strategies and so forth, and there are many other things that went into this, and I know we're going to have some later presentations on this site probably because we've continued to do support on this at some later time, so tune in for that. Slide 20, we're moving to the next sort of site. This is in Nebraska. This is a vision of how if you use these diagrams, how you want to try to present the information, not in black space, because we just talked about what's so important about geology and the control on geology and design of a program, but you want to put your contamination in a frame of reference of geology. And this is a location where you had PERC, perchloroethylene plume, and it was in a big sand aquifer, and we were able to monitor temporally over time what happened with this plume, and in this case, MNA was the solution, each one of these progressive slides, if you move into 21, for example, you can see the plume migrated down gradient, then it bifurcated, and then the final slide, 22, shows kind of the remnants of the plume, and you can even use these temporal images to start to predict when will you get to closure, when will you be able to shut the system off, and you can communicate that information to your stakeholders easily, and you can actually take this information directly out of the model, put it into ModFlow, Visual ModFlow, and some of those predictive tools, and use them in combination. So it becomes a very powerful tool, and you can do it relatively inexpensively. You know, some of these models you can create for in the range of $40,000 to $50,000. So moving on to slide 23, using the CSM to design a sampling strategy, we talked about the intended reuse, talked about the action levels. We talked about how you boil down the data gap visualization. And you evaluate the threats to human health and the environment. And you move to slide 24. You use this information then to optimize your triad work strategy and to develop your sequencing, like we talked about in Tuesday's seminar, and to identify those technologies and, more importantly, how you're going to manage the data as it comes in. That is when you start to build conceptual site models, this third bullet is the most important thing that you ought to have in your radar screen. You ought to have it in your planning documents, because if you can't manage the data real time and do the quality assurance and control reviews and use tools that allow you to process and facilitate this stuff and update your CSM, then you're still going to wind up in the same in place that you are with most traditional approaches. You're going to wind up waiting till you process all the data, create all the visualizations, and then ultimately go out and do another mobilization, which we try to avoid when you're doing the triad. So moving on to slide 25, this is a slide of how a dynamic work strategy was developed for the Jackson Ceramic site, how sequencing was built into it, and what it shows here is that the project team was planning to do some more investigative work and use geostatistics to try to figure out where the low-level contamination was into the outside parts of that kind of yellow hatchered area. Then, in addition to that, they were going to go into the source area shown in blue and in red and use a finer grade grid, because we really needed to know what we're going to do with that stuff, because it's all above 10,000 ppm and it's screaming hot. It's a long-term potential source, and so we need better control on volumes and costs for the FS. And then we placed wells in specific locations and surface water samples along identified corridors, and we put all this stuff into kind of a sequenced approach. And it was a result of the development of all those preliminary CSMs. Now, looking back on Melrose in the same fashion, you know, we had a dynamic work strategy that we were going to be able to apply here by using passive soil gas. And the nice thing about passive soil gas is we were able to basically riddle the site with locations, and instead of going back and looking at all the past reuse information, we were going to use soil gas to tell us where the biggest issues were. So it really drove us to use kind of a different type of process to do our initial evaluation of the site. And it worked very well, and we've come up since then with some localized hotspots that we want to go in and do more work on.
Robert, about 5 more minutes.
So here's just another example of a dynamic work strategy. For Little James Creek, a mining site, where XRF is going to be used along with a conceptual site model to explore drainages, explore adits, explore mine tailing piles, all kind of with the hopes of taking these preferential pathways and collecting the kind of information that we needed to predict loading from this mine into the stream that runs parallel to the road shown on this diagram. So, just another example of how conceptual site models and understanding of past use and is used to create a dynamic work strategy that can be more efficient. So, in summary, using and building the consensus vision, it's important because it helps you identify data gaps, identify data collection activities, maintain an environment of trust. Selling points, are that you save time, money, and eliminate uncertainty. Figure 29 shows, basically how this is used. And a CSM is something that gets evolved. And in addition to these kind of basic approaches, the thing to remember is there are new technologies like that one shown in slide 30 that are emerging like crazy, give you all sorts of new information. And when you're building conceptual site models, you need to be creative. This tool allows you to look at the flow of groundwater, the flux of contaminants, on a 1 foot to 2 foot interval up and down wells, and that's an extremely powerful information. And if you look at sample slide 31, that shows how this data gets dumped out. And of course, this is a very non-traditional form of information, but as you see in slide 31, these are the fluxes. And if you look at the far right hand side, you can see there's a peat level, a peat shown in kind of pinkish purple, that we thought was an aquitard. And the blue lines shown in these flux meter responses are the groundwater flux. Well, you can see the groundwater flux between the sands or silts above it and the peat layer below it are identical. So this peat level layer has been used as an aquitard for a long time. By using this passive flux meter technology, we will be able to determine if anything, it was as permeable, if not more permeable, than the material above it. So, that's a very brief look at passive flux meters. There's a lot of other types of tools out there that people should consider. Hopefully you'll try to be creative, you'll go out, you'll build conceptual site models, and you'll find out, as I have in the last 20 years of my career, that they're an extremely helpful tool, and hopefully this process or kind of, procedure for creating these things will help you in designing your own. So slide 32, that's about all I've got, and if there's any questions, I'll take them now.
Thank you, Robert. Any questions for Robert?
Just a reminder, if you have muted your phone lines, you can hit #6 to unmute your line to ask your questions out loud on the phones.
Robert, this is Stuart. I actually have a question. The types of three-dimensional diagrams you showed for some of the sites, are those representations that are capable of being generated in the field in real time or near real time, or exactly how much of that type of spatial information and depth profile information is generally available in the field?
Right.
Those were created using a program called EBS Pro, managing visualization software. Those can be generated in the field if you plan appropriately with your data management. There are other tools that, I mean, those are very sophisticated and very crisp and clear images. And there are other tools, freeware tools like Theta, for example, that can be used in the field to create more crude 3D visualizations to guide field activity. And in an upcoming tech bulletin on data visualization, we discuss those kinds of advantages and limitations of certain types of tools. A tool like MVS is rather sophisticated, but it can be generated in near real time. So say, for example, you were to go halfway through your field program, say a several-week program, during the first week you could be collecting data, and during the second week you could be dumping it all into MVS and coming up with an image like this, so that before you reach the end of your program, you could have this model, which would be not very far behind your investigative activities. With Theta, you can do it real time every day. You just dump it in. So long as your database is structured to have the right fields and the right information dumped into it electronically, then QC'd, that information, and certainly the 2D information that you can get out of many different of these software programs can be done real time, and that's always the best, because these tools are great for a number of reasons. I mean, one, it's got a nice visualization, but two, it's a tremendous tool for managing uncertainty, because they use kriging and they use uncertainty management tools to help you optimize locations. And these probability plots that they can generate, and the vector flow diagrams that you can use to look for well locations. Those things are a tremendous uncertainty management tool that allow us to not only manage the analytical uncertainty, but allow us to manage the spatial uncertainty and the sampling uncertainty on a very fine scale as well as a broad scale. So these tools are great to use real time. You just have to use, be ready with the database, have the right fields in there, and then, make sure that it's getting QC'd, and then that you can dump them out as quickly as you can. But yeah, you can use them. I use different ones for different types of sites or where I have different types of needs. But you can create them real time.
Great. Other questions? Any other questions?
This is Jean. I have a question. I just didn't know what sort of facilitation or assistance in the communication to your entire team these types of visualization packages have provided. Have you found that they've improved the dialogue and helped people come to consensus about what the problem really was at a site?
I think they do. I think that they have been, they certainly allow you to take, your normal cross-section, which is just a very one-dimensional sort of two-dimensional cut across the site, and begin to think of things, three-dimensionally. And I think all of our sites are three-dimensional sites. And one of the biggest problems is we tend to think two-dimensionally. And this gets us out of that a little bit more to look at how these things work. And, And I think that, it's not always necessary to do these 3D visualizations. I think if you have a site where you have very shallow contamination and you have, a certain type of surface water problem, like, say, at Axon Ceramics, that a tool like this would be of more limited value. But if you go to a place like Phoenix where you've got a big water supply at 200 feet below ground surface and really complex geology between there and the surface forces, then it's an extreme benefit. And right now, just the state of the industry is such that most people, like, who provide these services, like the vendors who do LIF or the vendors who do membrane interface probe work that provide these services, they're not putting that data in the context of the geology. They're putting contamination out there in black space and basically just mapping contamination and instrument responses. And if there's something to really take away from this presentation is that is not adequate for design and planning purposes. We need to go to the next step to integrate geology and hydrogeology into contaminant distribution to come up with a good sampling strategy and a good remedial design. It's just not happening right now in the industry. Now, Navy is moving in that direction. A whole newly structured database that they're using to get conceptual site model information, things like geologic tops, bore logs, those kinds of things into their database so they can create these kinds of models. But traditionally, people have not done that, and that's where the disconnect happens. So we need to be diligent as practitioners to go out, make sure that not only are we looking at contaminant distributions, but we're looking at geology and hydrogeology in combination with contaminant distributions and all this other stuff for us to do a real good job to get to the endpoint as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And that's the whole point of this holistic conceptual site model, is to get us to kind of broaden our horizons from what we originally thought a CSM was, which was a pathway receptor network diagram or geology descriptions, to integrate all this stuff together and to do it for much real time and try to make sure that we're not leaving these critical elements out of this collaborative data picture. Because without all those elements, you're going to make the wrong decisions. And the triad's all about, improving decision quality and decision certainty. And to do that, we need to bring all these factors together.
Great. Any other questions? Well, if there are none, I want to thank both Robert and Tom for two excellent presentations. And in closing, a couple of reminders. One is for you to fill out your feedback forms, and please send those in as soon as you can. Again, they're very valuable to the Triad community and EPA for input. I want to remind you about the next upcoming presentation, which will be on August 11th. August 11th at from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and the subject matter for that presentation is going to be Triad during RD/RA. And the final closing remark that I have, in addition to again thanking our speakers for some excellent remarks, is that the participants, all of us here today, are part of the bigger Triad community of practice that I mentioned earlier on. And it's a group of people who are interested in promoting the use of Triad and its implementation in the regulatory world. And if you want more details on that open forum, you can contact Mr. Thomas Heim, H-E-I-M, of Environmental Measurement Support. And his email is thomas.heim@emsus.com. Where you can email any of us, Gene or myself or Robert or Tom, and all of us can put you in touch with Tom Heim, and we'll be glad to invite you to participate in that community of practice. With that, Jean, any closing remarks you wish to add at this point?
Just a reminder, if people are trying to get to that feedback form, it is on the very last slide in the PowerPoint presentation. We have a copy of the spreadsheets that Tom was referencing, and we'll get those posted this afternoon on the additional resources page for today's event. And as you mentioned, there's another event coming up next week as part of the series, and that this event was recorded, so if anyone did experience difficulties getting in or hearing the complete session, we did get a complete recording of everything, and we'll expect to have that posted on the Kluwen Archives page in about 1 to 2 weeks.
Well, with that, if there are no other questions or remarks, everyone have a great day, and again, thanks to our speakers for a great job.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
Yep.